This will be our final presentation. I want to thank you once again for coming this evening. And for those of you who came this evening and yesterday evening, you guys are my heroes. Thank you so much for valuing this enough to come and give your time to it. We're going to begin in Matthew 6, verse 10. Again, we are staying within the Jesus story. We're not going to be looking at what the Christian religion has taught per se. We're just going to be sticking within the Jesus story on this topic. A few years back now, I was riding across the country on Delta Airlines. I fly so much, they are now giving me complimentary first class tickets. And I noticed that people in first class are way more relaxed than they are in the sardine section in the back. And one gentleman, I was reading a book one day of a religious nature, and he was sitting beside me, and he leans over and he says, "Oh," he says, "you're a Christian." And I looked at him, looked at what I was reading, put two and two together, realized how he had deduced that. And I said to him, "Actually, no. I said, I'm not a Christian. I said, I do endeavor to follow Jesus, but I'm not a Christian." He said, "That's weird. Why do you say it like that?" And I said, "Well, I just see a growing difference between what Christianity is known for today and what that Jewish carpenter was known for 2,000 years ago." I said, "Are you religious?" He said, "No." I said, "Were you raised religious?" He said, "Yes, that's why I'm not now." We had a great conversation for about 6 hours that day on that flight. And about halfway through it, I asked him, I said, "Well, what do you think about this Jesus guy?" He says, "Well, I hate religion, but that Jesus guy, that guy intrigues me." So we started talking about him for a while. A little while longer in the conversation, he said, "Okay, let's say those Christians are right. Let's say there is a God." And he said, "Let's say you're right. Let's say that that God looks just like Jesus." He said, "Well, then can you explain to me this? Why is the suck factor of my life so high?" Can anyone identify with what he's asking? If there's a God out there that looks as nice and as, you know, as concerned with human suffering as Jesus was, then why am I in so much trouble? Why is my life a train wreck? It's a valid question. The philosophical question is, if there's a good God, why is there so much human suffering? I think all of us in the room have asked that question to some at some level. Have we not wrestled with that at some level? Matthew 6:10, again, I believe the Jesus story gives us a very different answer. If you were to ask our Hindu brothers and sisters today why there is evil, they don't consider it to be the problem of evil. They just say it must have been something you've done in a future life, or in a past life, sorry. They believe in reincarnation. So if you're suffering, whose fault is it? It's yours. If you were to ask our Muslim brothers and sisters why they believe in there's human suffering, it's not a problem for them either. Matter of fact, to even ask why Allah would allow suffering, they say is blasphemous. It's blasphemous to ask questions of Allah. Just accept it. If you were going to go to our good Buddhist brothers and sisters and ask them why is there human suffering, they'd say there's no such thing as suffering. It's all just perception. If you could see, it's not real reality. If you could see it correctly, you would see there's no such thing as human suffering. It's all just how you perceive things. I find it interesting that if you go to Christians today and ask them why is there human suffering, you'll get one of those three answers. You'll either get the Hindu answer, somebody somewhere sinned, there's a tsunami in Japan, must be their morality. There's a flood in New Orleans, oh, rampant immorality. How many of you've heard those reasons before? I was in New Orleans a little while ago, and I took a historical tour of the French Quarter. What I thought was interesting is, do you know which section of New Orleans is built on the highest elevation? The French Quarter. Do you know which section in the French Quarter is on the highest elevation of that quarter? Bourbon Street. Do you know which section of New Orleans received zero flood damage during the flooding of New Orleans? The French Quarter. I would submit to you that if the flooding of New Orleans was, as Christians say, for the gross immorality, and the entire city was flooded except for the French Quarter, that was an act of God, then God missed with his lightning bolt. See, these oversimplified religious answers don't add up when we actually compare them to reality. If you were to ask a Christian why they're suffering, some might say, well, there's no such thing. If you could just see it from God's perspective, you'd see this as a blessing, not a curse. His ways aren't our ways. Providence writes straight with crooked lines. How many have heard those kinds of answers before? That's the Buddhist answer. Or you could hear from Christians, it's blasphemous to even ask the question, why? Don't ask questions. God's ways aren't our ways. The Jesus story gives us a radically different answer, but it's going to challenge us to our core. Again, we're not debating whether the story is true or not. We're just trying to find out what the story is really even saying. In Matthew 6, verse 10, Jesus prays, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This is an insightful prayer into the headspace of the Jesus of this story. According to this story, this Jesus doesn't think God's will is being done on planet earth. And he seems to indicate that God's will won't be done unless somebody does what? Prays. That's what we're praying for. That's a real hard departure from Calvinistic Reform Christianity that believes that nothing happens unless omnipotence wills it to happen. Most of the Christians that I was raised with, they reason out human suffering like what I have on the screen. They go through four words in their logic. They assume if God wanted to prevent something, that he could. Since he didn't, he must have wanted it to happen. And that's why you'll have some Christians say things like, everything's happening just the way God wants it to. Or they may not say it that bluntly. They'll say everything is happening according to God's will, or God's plan, or God's purpose. And it sells a lot of books. Jesus seems to indicate that God's will isn't being followed on planet Earth. In Luke 7, verse 30, it says the Pharisees and the lawyers, they rejected the, what does it say? The will of God. So according to the story at least indicates that the perspective of the story is that God's will can be rejected. In Luke 13, 34, Jesus says these words in Luke's version, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you kill the prophets and stone those who are sent to you. How often I have longed to gather you and your children together as hens gather her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." Now, this story is told in the context of a cultural reality where they actually believed that if someone was sinning, if someone was suffering, it was because they had sinned. We talked about this a little bit last night. It was built on a misunderstanding of Deuteronomy 28 that simply says, if you obey, God will bless you. If you disobey, God will curse you. And so therefore, if you're suffering, somebody somewhere must have sinned. God's cursing you. That's why in Luke or John 9, if you look in the gray section there, they run into this guy who was born blind, and his disciples, Jesus' disciples in this version of the story, ask, "Teacher, whose sin caused him to be blind? Was it his own or his parents' sin?" I don't know how his own sin could have caused him to be born blind since he hadn't sinned yet. But Jesus answered, "Neither did this man sin nor his parents, rather let the works of God be manifest in him." Two things I want to draw your attention to is that within the Jesus story, it seems that God is not as controlling as sometimes he is portrayed by others to be. John, who spent 3 years being, according to the story, being mentored by Jesus, summed up his understanding of God as, within three words, he said, "God is love." And I want to talk about love and control for a moment. Control is not giving people the ability to say no to you. Love is quite the opposite. How many would agree with that? You see, let's say I controlled everything my wife did. Like I could, but let's say I tried. I determined when she woke up in the morning, what she ate in the morning, what she ate for lunch, or what she ate for dinner, what she did in between every meal, what she did in her free time, who she talked to on the phone, what she did in her evening time. I so meticulously scheduled her day, I even scheduled in for her bathroom breaks. Do you get the picture? Would you say that I was the most loving husband to ever walk the planet? No. What would you call me? A control freak. That's right. Drop the word control and what would I just be? A freak. That's right. We look at people that have to control at that magnitude and we say something is emotionally wrong with that person. The Jesus that we find in the Jesus story, and he continually said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you get to know me, you get to know the Father. Jesus doesn't seem to be in control in the Jesus story. Matter of fact, the picture we get is that of an incarnate God who is actually actively engaged in a formidable struggle for his will to be done on earth like it's done in heaven. It's not automatically being done. We find Jesus struggling. We find strange elements in the Jesus story, and this is a difficult one. In Luke 4, 5 through 6, it says, "The devil led him up to a high place and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of this world." Now, whether you believe in a literal devil or not, that's not the point this evening. Just look at what the story says. There's a third party. It's not just God. It's not just us in the story. There's a third party in the story. There's an enemy. What's the point? What's the story truth here? It says, "And the devil led him up, showed him all the kingdoms of the world, and he said to him, 'I will give you all their authority and splendor, for it has been given to me, and I can give it to anyone I want to.'" So according to the story, this world belongs not to the God of Jesus, but to the enemy of Jesus, to this third party. I'm not saying you believe that. I'm saying, can you see that in this story? If you can see that, say yes. That's the storyline. Psalms 115, the author here, some believe it's David, says, "The highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to whom?" Humankind. According to the Genesis narrative of the Hebrew Scriptures, humanity gave this planet to that third party, to the serpent. And once again, I know talking snakes are hard to buy. Don't miss the point of the story, the story truth. In 1 John 5:19, the Apostle John writes, "We know that we are children of God and that the whole world is under the control of," what does it say? The evil one. Now, you can say this is a very mythological period for human culture, and that's fine. But at least notice what they believed, that the world was not under the control of some divine puppet master pulling all the strings, but that there was a third party that Jesus had come to engage and to change the way life was done on planet Earth. We talked about this in the first half. We talked about how humanity is enslaved to a systemic evil. How many would agree with that? If that's the only way you can explain it, then do that. But there's something else other than God, other than humanity, that humanity needs saved from. It's the systemic evil to which we are in bondage to, if that's the way you want to look at it. It says in Acts 10, verse 30, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and power, and how he went around doing good, healing all who were under the power of the, what does it say there? The devil. Because God was with him. Again, you find this storyline where it's not just God and it's not just people calling the shots of how things are done. You have this third element, this third party. In the Scriptures, in the New Testament, he's called the HaSatan. His name is not Satan. His name is not devil. That's his title. He's the Satan, the devil, the accuser. He's the third party. And once again, whether you believe he literally exists or not, catch the story truth. In Mark 8, 22 through 25, it says, "They came to Bethesda, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him," by the way, that's not a moral ethic that Jesus taught. If someone comes to you for help, don't spit in their eye, okay? Just how the story reads, and I don't understand the context here. It says, do you see anything? He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." And once more, he put his hands on the man's eyes, and his eyes were opened, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Now, how many find it odd here that even the Jesus of this story had to pray twice for this guy's healing? How many find that odd? What was going on? Today, Christians would say, well, maybe it wasn't God's will for him to be healed the first time. Well, you've got a problem, because the Jesus of the Jesus story here in Mark is claiming to be who? And he was willing. Some will say, well, you know, if you don't have an answer to prayer, maybe it's because you don't have enough faith. How many have heard that line before? Do you really want to say Jesus didn't have enough faith the first time he prayed? See, there's quandaries that are created here by our typical answers. What I want you to at least glean from this is that there's some third element that Jesus is fighting against for God's will to be done on planet Earth like it's done in heaven. Can we at least establish that? We're not defining that third element. It could be human will. It could be the systemic evil to which humanity is engaged in. It could be some mythological creature like a devil. It could be just the mob spirit like we discussed earlier that the whole group kind of becomes enslaved to and it actually gets away from them and they're actually controlled by it now. It could be anything, but it's not God. It's not these people. It's a third party. If you can at least see that in the story truth, say yes. Look at Matthew 13:53. This is another bizarre story. When Jesus had finished these parables, he moved on from there. Coming to his hometown, he began teaching the people in their synagogues. They took offense to him, and he did not do many miracles there. Now, what I want to ask you is, did he walk up to Nazareth, his hometown, and say, well, I would do the miracles here that I've done everywhere else? But I, for some good reason, and you'll just have to trust me, my ways aren't your ways, I'm choosing not to do those miracles here. Is that what we see happening in the story? You find a Jesus here who wants to do the same miracles. He wants to do the same miracles that he had done everywhere else in his hometown, but he, what's that second word? What's the opposite of that second word? But he couldn't. You find the same thing with the guy that he just had to pray for twice. He wanted him to heal the first time. He wanted to heal him the first time. But he couldn't and had to pray the second and could that time. Look at it again in Mark 9:29. The context of this is however you interpret by modern science, the story is there was a demon-possessed individual. And I understand mental health and all of that. But there was a demon-possessed individual in the story. And the disciples couldn't fix him. They tried, but they couldn't. Jesus comes down, fixes the mess, and then he replies, this kind can only come out by prayer. What does he mean, this kind? This kind of what? Can we at least say this is once again a third element that we haven't defined clearly? It's just a third element that they're engaging against to try to bring change on planet Earth. How many can begin to see this is a different reason for human suffering than it must be God's will? Or it must be you did something wrong? How many can begin to see there may be a different answer in the Jesus story than what we typically give? You see, freedom and divine capability. I had a couple friends who were having a birthday around the same time. They were living in Seattle and I was living in northeastern Washington State at the time. 7 hours away, they're having a birthday in the same week. I called them up and I said, hey, you guys are having a birthday in the same week. Why don't you drive 7 hours over to my house so I can celebrate your birthday with you? They said, Herb, the protocol of friendship states it's our birthday. You should drive 7 hours to our house to celebrate our birthday with us. I said, well, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but let's say you drive 7 hours to my house. I will take you to the grocery store, and I will let you choose anything you want for your birthday party, and I will pay for your party with my wallet. How many think that'd be a good deal? A free birthday party, anything you choose at Herb's expense. Is there anybody here that would take advantage of that? They did too, because 7 hours later, they were on my doorstep. True story. True to my word, I took them to the grocery store. The first thing they got was this natural vanilla Breyers ice cream. Anyone ever had natural vanilla Breyers ice cream? That stuff isn't even like normal ice cream, okay? It is so good. It is my favorite ice cream, by the way. But it is so good. I mean, you look at other ice creams, it's got a paragraph of ingredients. Yeah, and I speak English, and I still don't know what's in my ice cream on those others. You look at Breyers, it's simple. It's got four ingredients, and you can understand all four of them. And you can taste the simplicity. But back then, I was really into health, and so I believed that ice cream was really bad for you. And so when they got out that ice cream, I just looked at them. It's kind of the way a religious person would look at a visitor at their church if they broke one of their in-house rules. I looked at them with that look. Now, I didn't say this, but this look said, how could you eat that? Don't you know how bad that is for your body? You health sinner! That's basically what I was saying to them with the look. So I picked up the ice cream. I stuck it back in the freezer, and I got one of those non-dairy vanilla ice cream substitutes and stuck that in the cart. Now, back then, I thought they were healthier, but I'm not convinced anymore, and I'll tell you why just briefly because it is a tangent. Back then, those ice cream substitutes were made out of one of two substances. It was either rice or soy. How many know what I'm talking about? Soy ice cream or rice ice cream? I think it's funny that they call it soy ice cream. Do you know why they call it soy? It's to hide the truth from you. It's to lie to you, really. It's not soy. Soy is a bean. And beans don't have udders. So that is not soy milk. That is bean juice. Do you understand the difference? It's a marketing ploy. Can you imagine sitting across the breakfast table and asking someone to pass the bean juice so you could pour it on your cereal? No, no one's going to do that. No one's going to buy that. So they disguise it by calling it soy milk, and everybody now thinks it sounds delicious. The other one's made out of rice, and I understand that one a little bit more, but here's the problem that concerns me. I grew up poor. I know what rice and beans taste like. What do you got to do to rice and beans to make them taste like ice cream? That's unnatural. There is something wrong that has transpired in that process. That is not the way rice and beans tastes. So I'm not convinced those are any healthier for you, but I stuck one of those in the cart. We went to the cake department, got out one of those. They picked out one of these 5,000 different types of death by chocolate cake, stuck that in the cart. I looked at them again. I picked it up, stuffed it back on the shelf. I got one of those vanilla sugar-free diabetic cakes and put that in the cart. I know laboratory rats and all that. I get it. The next department we went to was the soda aisle. They got one of these 3-liter bottles of antifreeze, otherwise known as Mountain Dew. I looked at them again. And this time I just reached for the Mountain Dew. I actually didn't get my hands on it. All I could actually do was reach for it. I think they felt more passionately about their Mountain Dew than they did their cake and ice cream, or else they were just getting smarter. But the more vocal of the two, she picks up this Mountain Dew bottle before I could get my hands on it. She picks up this Mountain Dew bottle. She holds it close to her body like an abandoned orphan child. She interposes her body between me and the substance, and she sticks out her left hand. She looks me straight in the eye, and she says, "Hold on a minute, Herb. You said that if we came to your house, you would let us choose anything we want for our birthday party, and you've not let us have one thing that we chose." I said, "Oh, my dear friends, you didn't pay close enough attention to what I actually said, because I wanted this illustration so bad. Do not be my friend. I will mess with you. You didn't pay attention to what I actually said. I said, I only said you could choose anything you wanted for your birthday party. I never said you could have that which you chose." Now, without any thought, any time to come up with a response, she immediately came back with, "Well, Herb, if I'm not free to have what I chose, then I'm not really free to choose it in the first place." How many would agree with her philosophical point? The freedom to choose implies the freedom to have that which you've chosen, does it not? You see, freedom, for it to be genuine, it has to carry with it the quality of irrevocability. In other words, if I say, "Well, I'm giving you freedom to do this or this, but I want you to do this. If you choose this over here, I can't just step in and make what I want to happen happen." In other words, what I would be saying is, you're free to do whatever you want as long as you do what I want you to. And the moment you do something that I don't want you to, then I step in and make what I want to happen happen anyway. That may feel like freedom as long as you're doing what I want. But the moment you cross that, you begin to see how free you really are. How many would agree that's not real freedom at all? It may feel like it initially. What does it mean for Jesus to paint the picture in this story, for the early apostles to paint the picture in this story of a divine being, a God, who has given humanity the ability to say no to him? Does that at least create some third element that God has to now, in the story, formidably struggle against for his will to be done on earth like it's done in heaven? Does that create a struggle? And if it does this story begin to give at least a different philosophical answer to the problem of human suffering? Maybe it's not God. Maybe it's not us. Maybe there's this third element that's now created that God even has to war against and engage in. In other words, look at Titus 1, verse 2. Some will say, "Well, God can do anything." Look at what Paul says to Titus. "In the hope of eternal life, which God who what?" Does the Bible teach there's at least one thing? The New Testament teaches that there's at least one thing God can't do. Yeah. What is it here? lie. Whether you agree with it or not, I'm just asking you what it says. Some say, well, Herb, it's not that he can't lie, it's that he won't lie. Nothing's impossible for God, they say. Well, look at Hebrews 6:18, that by two unchangeable things in which it is, what's that word? For God to what? Is there at least one thing that's impossible for this God in this story? What I'm submitting to you, could there be other things? What about love? We'll go right to the point. Can God, according to the story, or let's just back out of the story, let's just talk philosophically for a moment. Can an all-powerful God make you love him? Not that he won't, can he if he wanted to? Let's say I created a computer chip. We'll just talk philosophically for a moment. I created a computer chip, and I programmed this computer chip to mess with the electromagnetic waves of a person's brain. And if I can just get this computer chip behind their ear, when they wake up, they'll think I'm the best thing since sliced bread. I don't care if it's Angelina Jolie. If you can get that sucker behind her ear, when she wakes up, she'll be head over heels in love with you. How many would be interested in a chip like that if it existed? Anyone? Anyone? Any takers? I'll tell you why. Let's say I got that chip behind my wife's ear. She wakes up. She thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread. In that moment, is she loving me? No. Who's loving me? Who programmed the chip? So who's loving me? Myself. Now, some Christians will say, well, God could come down here and wiggle the wires around in our head. What I'm submitting to you is that even if he did do that, according to your worldview, even if he did that on a philosophical level, you're still not loving him. He's now just loving himself through you, and that's sick. How many would agree with that? You see, the Jesus story paints a radically different picture of a God who is engaged in this struggle with us. He's endeavoring to change life on this planet with us, not in spite of us. So really, who is culpable when we talk about the suffering that takes place on planet Earth? Maybe not us individually, but could we say collectively? Are we setting in motion? How many have seen the movie The Curious Case of Benjamin Button? How many have seen that film? Do you remember the clip where the ballerina or the dancer gets struck by the car and it backs its way out to all the events that led up to why that accident happened? I don't think any... How many remember that clip that I'm talking about, that part of the movie? Go back and watch it. You'll see it. YouTube it. You'll find it. But I don't think anyone in that lineup intentionally tried to set in motion that accident. But were they setting in motion the reality that took place that day to that dancer? What about the movie The Butterfly Effect? How many have ever seen that based on the scientific theory of the chaos theory? See, quantum physics is beginning to show us that life on this planet may work radically different. There's a level of chaos that life may be functioning a little bit differently than what we've assumed. That's why even in Solomon's writings, look at Ecclesiastes 9:11, and I share this because this is a challenge not for philosophers, it's not a challenge for scientists, it's actually a challenge for those who put a lot of weight in these scriptures. Ecclesiastes 9:11 says, I have seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned, but time and, what's that word? Happen to them all. How can you have such a thing as chance if you have a God up there who's meticulously controlling everything? If God's controlling, there's no such thing as chance. What I find interesting is, does the Jesus story paint the picture of a deity that's meticulously controlling everything, where everything's turning out his way, or is he engaged in a formidable struggle for what he wants to happen like he wants it? Isaiah 5:20 warns us in the Hebrew narratives, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. How many have ever heard a good Christian say that before, where they say, well, if you could just see this from God's perspective, you'll see this is a blessing, not a curse. How many have ever heard that answer? The actual Hebrew narrative warns against that kind of language. Jesus actually promises in John 16:30, I've told you these things so that you may have peace. In the world, you will have what? Jesus actually promises us, in the world, you're going to have trouble. The world as it's orchestrated right now is you're going to have trouble. And the way you're going to change it might be through dying at the hands of your enemies to wake them up from the systemic evil. I don't see anybody walking around claiming this Bible promise. In the world, we're going to have trouble. I claim that promise in Jesus' name. I mean, no religious person's saying that, but it's there. In Revelation 21:5, the end of the New Testament narrative, whomever it was who wrote the book of Revelation, paints this picture in the end of the book. The one who was seated on the throne said, "See, I am making all things what? New." Did you see that in the Jesus story this evening? That Jesus was more preoccupied with changing life on planet Earth, healing the sick, bringing an end to human suffering. I mean, can you imagine if every religious institution in the world right now, I'm talking about within Christianity, would liquidate all assets, sell all church buildings? Do you know how much money the Christian, I'm talking Eastern Orthodox, Western Catholic, Protestant, the whole Anabaptist, the whole works, they all sold everything, liquidated all assets. Do you know how much money that would total? You could end world hunger forever 10 times over is what you could do. Which just makes me wonder if Jesus was really serious when he told the rich young ruler to sell everything you have and give it away to the poor. Today, Christianity is known for the Crusades. I'm submitting if Christianity just sold everything it had and gave it away to the poor, we could actually, Christianity could go down in history. Not for the Crusades, but for ending world hunger on planet Earth for good. How many think that would be a dream? Again, it's a dream, but how many think that would be? Behold, I make all things new. Revelation 21:4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, mourning, crying, or pain, for the old order of things are passed away. They talked about a day when all of this suffering would eventually come to an end. They didn't say that all of this was God's will and you just need to trust him that it's okay. Matthew 25:40, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it to me." Jesus painted the picture that he was in solidarity with the suffering. History is usually told by the oppressors, not those who are oppressed. Jesus says, "I stand with those who are being oppressed. I am with the homeless. I am with the hungry. I am with those who are in pain, abused by the tortures of war. I am with those who are passing on AIDS in Africa tonight to their newly born children." And he seems to be indicating to us that when we stand in solidarity with that section of the world's population in trying to end human suffering, then at that moment we are standing with the Jesus of the Jesus story as well. In Romans 8:28, it says, "We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose." What is his purpose according to the Jesus story? He's trying to make all things new. He's trying to recreate a new world, which means that even the trouble that we encounter, he's taking even the death that we could encounter and he's transforming it into a tool to use for creating a new world. How many would love to take the sting out of everything anyone has ever tried to do to you of a damaging nature, for that to be turned around to actually be a conduit where forgiveness can be experienced, reconciliation can be experienced, enemy love, enemy embracing can be experienced. We can actually use that as a means of setting in motion something that can change the world, something that's working for good rather than for bad. How many would love to see that happen with some of the atrocities that have happened in your life? This is what I believe the early Jesus story is teaching us, what it's teaching us to do. And in Genesis 50, verse 20, in the Genesis narrative, once again, the story that was so favored by the Hebrews of Joseph, he actually said to his brothers, according to the story, "The evil that you planned to do me has been, by God's design, turned to good." That's what we find being repeated in the Jesus story over and over again. The evil that the Romans and the religious leaders of Jesus' day sought to enact on Jesus. What did Jesus do with that violent hatred? He turned it around and used it as a way to model how we too, in following that and embracing a cross, might be conduits of world change and healing as well. Gandhi caught it. Martin Luther King caught it. Others have caught it, like the great Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day in the early 20s and 30s. Others have seen it. I'll close this entire weekend with these two verses. This Jesus story was not given in the vacuum of atheism. The Jesus story was given in the context of the existence of a God. Today we're being told that the solution to humanity's problems is to throw out religion. And I want to say amen. Hear me out. Religion won't solve humanity's problems. Religion, to a large degree, will only make humanity's problems worse. But the Jesus of the Jesus story did not come to create a religion. He came to create a revolution where people were not following a religion. Matter of fact, they were abandoning their religion to follow that person. And that person was not teaching religious duties as a means of gaining post-mortal assurance or bliss. He was teaching a series of ethics that he believed if we followed them, they could bring the reestablishment of a new world on planet Earth. He called it the kingdom, and he taught his followers to pray for his kingdom to come once again on earth as it is in heaven. He said the meek would inherit the earth. His entire focus was reestablishing a new way of doing life on planet Earth. And then he turns around at moments. And in John 14:9, he says, "Have I been so long with you, Philip, and yet you still don't know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the," what does he say? He has the audacity in this story to say that if there is a God, that God looks like me. In John 1:17, John, who had spent 3 years with Jesus, said, yeah, the law was given through Moses. The eye for an eye thing, yeah, that came through Moses. But grace, this way of responding to our enemies with grace and mercy and forgiveness, that was taught to us through who? And then he said, truth also came through Jesus. This truth of the way to life being doing unto others as we would have them do unto us, rather than the eye for an eye retaliation. John goes so far, having been raised in a Jewish culture on Moses and Elijah, he goes so far as to say that no one has ever even seen God once they bump into Jesus. Once you see Jesus, you'll realize you've never seen God up until that moment. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made Him known. These are high claims to be made by this Jesus of the Jesus story. These are high claims to be made by those who are writing these stories back then. I would submit to you that these are individuals who are endeavoring not to make people religious, while at the same time not throwing out the idea of a deity. They leave intact the existence of a God, but rather than embracing God religiously, they embraced God ethically, allowing the Jesus of their story to redefine who they believed God was. And this is the danger of religion. This is what we shared last night. As William Temple said, if your picture of God is incorrect, the more religious you become, the more dangerous you become to yourself and everyone else around you. The way that the early Jesus followers were going to change the world was not by abandoning the idea of a God, but by defining God according to a non-violent Jewish carpenter, which means fundamentally, God is non-violent. God is love. God, the God of the Jesus story is a God who embraces His enemies rather than torches them. The God of the Jesus story is a God who forgives His enemies of His own volition. The story we get of deity within the Jesus story is not the story of Jonathan Edwards, if you're familiar with his Puritan famous sermon. It is not the story of sinners in the hands of an angry God. The Jesus story paints the picture of a God in the hands of angry sinners. Radical paradigm shifts. How many have been given this weekend at least something to chew on, at least something to think about and ponder? A different way of looking at things. I'm submitting to you that Christian and non-Christian alike, if you're a Christian, I would encourage you to revisit the Jesus story, to try to get into the headspace of what the Jesus of the Jesus story was all about, what His passions were, what His kingdom was all about, what He was trying to accomplish. If you are not a Christian this weekend, I want to say to you, you are a little bit at an advantage there. And please don't take offense, Christians. But the non-Christians, you don't have the baggage. You don't have the stuff you're going to have to unlearn before you can learn. I want to encourage the non-Christians this weekend to take a look at the Jesus story afresh and allow it to define itself, to explain itself, rather than seeing it through the lens of Americanized Western Christianity. I believe that if we can come to terms, both Christian and non-Christian alike, with at least the ethical teachings of the Jesus story, it will give us the hope of not only seeing God in a different light, if there is a God, it would give us the hope of seeing even ourselves in a different light as human beings. And it will give us the ability to look at everyone else around us in a different light as well, including our enemies. And these new ways of seeing things may create new ways of thinking about things. And those new ways of thinking about things may create new ways of feeling about things. And all of that may synergize one day to a new way of doing life on planet Earth, a new way of choosing how to live and how not to live. And it may bring the healing of human society. That's my hope. I'm submitting it to you as a possible hope for yourself as well. Again, thank you for having me at North Dakota State University this weekend. I pray it has been worth your time. I've certainly enjoyed my time with you. God bless you and follow Jesus. Thank you for having me.